to eliminate any options is just a hard thing for folks, given the high costs that we have.
Alaska's senators vote to continue short-term bare-bones health insurance plans. From Alaska Public Media, this is statewide news on Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 10th. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, lobbyists appear to be violating a ban on political fundraising by inviting people to fundraisers.
It's disingenuous to claim that promoting a fundraiser is not fundraising. It's the same thing.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources.
25 years ago, the Alaska legislature made it illegal for lobbyists to raise money for political candidates. The idea was to reduce the role of special interests in the legislative process, since lawmakers might have a harder time saying no to lobbyists who help with campaign fundraising. But some of Alaska's most influential lobbyists have been helping to boost fundraising efforts by the governor, House Speaker, and powerful state senators. Nat Herz with Alaska's Energy Desk investigates.
Alaska law bans lobbyists from fundraising for political candidates. But one of the state's highest paid lobbyists, Jerry Mackey, acknowledges that he's distributed invitations to political fundraisers for candidates including the governor and House Speaker.
Well, yes, I have occasionally sent out emails to clients and friends for a couple of fundraisers for political candidates.
I talked to Heather Hebden, the head of the state's lobbying enforcement agency, the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Hebden wouldn't speak on tape, but she says the plain language of the law makes it pretty clear that emails like the ones Mackey has sent aren't allowed. David Finkelstein agrees. He's a former state legislator who helped write the fundraising ban more than 25 years ago.
It's disingenuous to claim that promoting a fundraiser is not fundraising. It's the same thing.
Finkelstein says this stuff is important because of the way lobbyists can accumulate power by fundraising for candidates. If a lobbyist has helped a lawmaker get into office, it can give the lobbyist leverage when they're pushing the lawmaker to vote a certain way. Finkelstein says he experienced something like this when he was in the legislature, when a lobbyist was trying to get a bill through Finkelstein's committee.
There was definitely a message from him connecting past and future contributions to my support.
Finkelstein says the lobbyist had helped raise money for Finkelstein's political campaigns. The lobbyist's suggestion was that if the bill died in Finkelstein's committee, the lobbyist would stop helping Finkelstein with his campaigns. Or, Finkelstein says, he would even help raise money for Finkelstein's challenger.
I had many experiences where I would have, you know, a lobbyist or a set of lobbyists mad at me because somehow they assumed that they'd help me and I was going to vote their way. That sort of connection occurs all the time, and that was what the new law was designed to rein in.
Hebden, from the Public Offices Commission, says that if there's a trend of lobbyists sending out invitations, her agency will at least have to ask them to stop. The state can also criminally prosecute a lobbyist who knowingly breaks the lobbying law, with a fine of up to $1,000 and up to a year in prison for a conviction. The lobbyists say they were acting with the blessing of their enforcement agency. Mackey says that before he sent out any invitations, he got a letter from an agency employee that references a caveat in the law. The caveat says that in spite of the fundraising ban, lobbyists can still, quote, personally advocate on behalf of a candidate.
And I'll quote directly from the letter. It says, "You asked about passing along information to friends and clients regarding fundraisers or events for candidates you personally advocate for. And I determined that as long as you're just informing them and in no way connected to the fundraiser, there is not a problem."
Ashley Reed, a longtime lobbyist in Juneau, says it's been common knowledge in his industry that emailing fundraiser invitations is an okay thing to do. But Hebden, the enforcement chief, says lobbyists have only received informal advice from her staff, which won't protect them from a complaint. Her agency's guidance is only binding when its politically appointed commissioners issue a formal advisory opinion, which lobbyists can ask for. Reed and Mackey, the two lobbyists, both say that if the commission decides that it's not kosher for them to send the emails, they'll stop. Here's Reed.
If they say it's no longer copacetic to do, then I'll stop immediately. I won't do it again until I see something to the contrary.
But the lobbyists also say they're frustrated to hear two different opinions from officials at the state agency that polices them. In Anchorage, I'm Nat Herz.
Last weekend, Senator Lisa Murkowski made headlines for breaking with her party over the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. Today, she rejoined her Republican caucus on a controversial health care vote. Murkowski, along with Senator Dan Sullivan, voted to greenlight the extension of short-term bare-bones health insurance plans. Democrats say the change is part of a Trump administration plan to sabotage the Affordable Care Act. But as Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin reports, Murkowski doesn't see it that way.
Senator Tammy Baldwin, a Wisconsin Democrat, led an effort to get rid of the Trump administration rule, and she made an obvious play for the two remaining swing votes on health care.
Mr. President, just over a year ago in this chamber, three brave Republican colleagues, Senator John McCain, Senator Susan Collins, and Senator Lisa Murkowski, joined all Democrats in voting against health care repeal legislation. They listened to the families of their states.
Baldwin needed to win over two Republicans to nullify the new rule that extends short-term plans. She got just one, Collins. Baldwin's resolution failed on a vote of 50-50. That leaves the Trump administration's rule in place. It allows people to be on the short-term plans for up to 3 years. During the Obama administration, the limit was 1 year. Then it was reduced to 3 months. The short-term plans can exclude coverage for things like pre-existing conditions and pregnancy.
These plans are junk insurance.
That's Senator Chuck Schumer, the Democratic minority leader.
This administration wants to let these junk insurance plans run rampant and let people be duped into thinking they're having insurance when it covers almost nothing.
They might appeal to young, healthy people, which Democrats say would leave only older, sicker people in the individual market, driving up the cost of their insurance. Murkowski says she voted to keep the 3-year term because she wants Alaskans to have the option of a cheaper plan, even if it has less coverage.
To eliminate any options is just a hard thing for folks, given the high costs that we have.
But Murkowski doesn't see the Spartan plans as a permanent solution.
I don't think that we're at that sweet spot yet. I think 3 years is too long. But I also think that 3 months is too short.
Alaska Insurance Division Director Lori Wing Heyer expects only about 500 Alaskans will buy short-term plans under the new rule. She does not think the extension will undermine the state's individual market.
Not really.
Most Alaskans have insurance sponsored by their employers or the government. Only 18,000 Alaskans buy their own plans on the individual market. Wing Heyer says nearly all of them get a subsidy. Switching to a short-term plan with skimpier coverage isn't going to be attractive to them, Wing Heyer says, because they would have to give up their subsidy.
We think for people that just have not bought anything because they were not eligible for a subsidy and consequently they're bare, those will be the people that look at these short-term plans.
The Senate's vote keeping the 3-year limit for short-term plans fell along party lines, with the exception of Collins, who voted with the Democrats. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Murkowski also pushed back against President Trump this week after he had said voters will never forgive her for opposing Kavanaugh's nomination. Murkowski says she knows her state's political terrain better than he does. Trump also said the senator will never recover politically, but Murkowski, who isn't up for re-election until 2022, told reporters that her barometer is not necessarily what the president says, but what the people of Alaska say. She acknowledges that some voters are disappointed in her decision, but says that's unavoidable because Alaskans were split on whether Kavanaugh should be confirmed. Murkowski got a vote of confidence Wednesday from Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell, who told the Associated Press in an interview that nobody's going to beat her in Alaska. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kenai's controversial invocation policy is struck down in Superior Court.
Very grateful that the judge saw the case the same way we did, which was that this policy was a policy born of intolerance.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com. And by Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute, committing to improving the lives of Alaskans. Using a team approach, Alaska Heart and Vascular Institute offers a range of cardiovascular diagnoses and care. Learn more at alaskaheart.com.
The Matanuska Susitna Borough School District is reaching out to the families of more than 300 students who had classes with a popular teacher now accused of inappropriately touching children. Wasilla police arrested 36-year-old Lucas Neiswanger on September 26th. He faces 4 felony counts of sexual abuse of a minor for alleged incidents as far back as 2008. Neiswanger, a BP Teacher of Excellence in 2015, taught at Iditarod Elementary. School district spokesperson Jillian Morrissey says the district sent a letter to the families of roughly 330 students Neiswanger taught.
The number one priority is to help get support to students who may have been harmed by this individual.
There appear to have been at least 2 reports against Neiswanger in the years leading up to his arrest. Morrissey says a complaint against him to Wasilla Police in 2012 did not lead to charges at the time, and she says the police did not notify the school district of the report, according to police department protocol. In an interview with the Anchorage Daily News, an Anchorage Police Department spokesperson said that APD would notify the school district in such an instance. Morrissey says the school district itself got a complaint in January of this year that it investigated internally.
But at the time, when through the investigation protocol and following that, there were no criminal allegations made, and so the protocol was followed and action was taken according to what was discovered.
Morrissey says the district took action but is barred from discussing it because of personnel rules. But she says Neiswanger was not terminated until the day he was arrested several months later. For now, Morrissey says the district is still in the initial phase of contacting and hearing back from parents. Neiswanger remains jailed on $100,000 bail, at least half of which would have to be paid in cash. After a roughly 2-year court battle, a state superior court judge ruled Tuesday that the Kenai Peninsula Borough's invocation policy is unconstitutional. However, this may not be the end of the road for this case. As KBBI's Aaron Bolton reports, the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly still needs to decide whether to appeal Tuesday's ruling.
Tuesday's decision found that the Borough Assembly's 2016 rewrite of its invocation policy took a step toward establishing an official religion by excluding minority faiths, therefore violating the state constitution's establishment clause. The ruling is a big win for the American Civil Liberties Union of Alaska. The ACLU sued the borough over the policy in late 2016, arguing it violated some borough residents' right to freedom of speech after they were prohibited from giving an invocation. ACLU spokesperson Casey Reynolds.
We're very grateful that the judge saw the case the same way we did, which was that this policy was a policy born of intolerance.
The policy restricted invocations to leaders of recognized congregations that hold regular meetings in the borough. The assembly implemented the policy following an invocation led by Iris Fontana, one of 3 plaintiffs in the case. Fontana's prayer ended in the words, "Hail Satan." Assemblymember Willie Dunn is also pleased with the ruling. The borough's policy has precluded several of Dunn's constituents from leading a prayer before assembly meetings.
I believe that our policy is discriminatory and prevents some people from giving invocations while allowing other people to give them, and I'm happy to see that the situation is temporarily settled. We'll see where we go from here.
The decision whether to appeal the case will ultimately be up to the assembly. There have been several attempts to change the borough's current policy. The most recent push came in early 2017, but failed in a 6-3 vote. However, 2 new members have since been elected to the assembly, possibly changing its views on the matter. In the meantime, the policy will need to be changed. Borough Mayor Charlie Pierce said he was ready to work with the legal department to draft new language during Tuesday's assembly meeting.
We will have to make some modifications to the existing policy or practices that are being followed, and we will follow the directives of the court on the interim. And again, you'll have an opportunity to decide whether you choose to appeal the ruling or not.
It's unclear when the Assembly may revisit the current policy, though it will likely be soon. It's also unknown when Assembly members will discuss whether they want to appeal Tuesday's ruling. The ACLU says if the borough does move in that direction, it will continue to fight the case. The Assembly's next regular meeting is on October 23rd. With help from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, I'm Aaron Bolton reporting in Homer.
Governor Bill Walker and the two candidates running to unseat him pitched their ideas Tuesday in Fairbanks on how to promote the state's tourism industry. Walker and former Republican State Senator Mike Dunleavy, along with former Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Begich, talked about tourism and other issues during an Alaska Tourism Industry Association candidate forum. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The incumbent and his two challengers found much to agree on during a candidates forum hosted by the organization that advocates for the state's tourism industry. All three candidates say the state should boost funding for infrastructure like highways, airports, and ferry and cruise ship facilities. But they also clashed with Walker over his contention that he had to cut funding for the industry and make other tough decisions during the state's economic downturn.
You know, we have pent-up opportunities in Alaska, but we had to balance our budget. It was not fun. It was a lot of work. Some quit. Some didn't, and we got it done.
As he has throughout the campaign, Walker defended his decisions to sharply cut the state budget over the past 3 years after oil prices plunged and Senate Republicans refused his proposals to adopt other sources of revenue.
You need someone that's going to bring stability, that you can look out into the years ahead and not wonder, is the price of oil going to cause your revenue to go away? We brought that stability.
Walker says he wants to help the industry promote year-round tourism, especially for visitors from Asia. Begich says Alaska needs bold leadership to boost tourism. He cited his push to get the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center built 10 years ago when he was mayor of Anchorage.
We had the same problems, budget crash, crime up, everything that you can imagine. We not only worked on that, but we also did something else. Even though the year before it had failed at the ballot box, we said we're going to take on building a convention center for our city.
Dunleavy's a conservative Republican and the frontrunner in the three-way contest. He says he'd take a small government approach for both the tourism industry and the state's economy overall.
I believe that we can get this budget under control, and I believe through the right policies and working directly with you folks, we can actually grow your industry as well as others, create more jobs.
The three candidates all pledged to work with federal authorities to increase access to national parks. Dunleavy says he'd also task the state Fish and Game Department to increase stocking fish in lakes and to develop policies that would ensure there's enough wildlife for tourists to see.
What I want to make sure you know is that you're going to have a governor that's not going to do things to you, but help you actually grow your business as we move forward.
All three candidates also said they'd restore funding for the Travel Industry Association's marketing efforts that the legislature had reappropriated over the past few years. The funding, which comes from a tax on rental vehicles, fell from $16 million in fiscal 2013 to $1.5 million last year after Walker vetoed part of the appropriation. He's recently pledged to boost funding to $12 million. Both challengers said they'd protect the tourism marketing funding from future reappropriations. Begich says the funding is essential, the recession notwithstanding, in order for the industry to grow.
Even in bad times, you have to invest.
Begich says he also favors a two-year budget cycle to give businesses in tourism and other industries more time to plan ahead. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Girdwood's Alyeska Resort is set to be sold. In a statement Tuesday, marketing director Eric Fullerton said the resort has entered into a contract to sell substantially all of its resort assets to the Canadian company Pomeroy Lodging. Fullerton said the transaction is expected to close before the end of the year. Pomeroy Lodging is a hospitality company based in Grand Prairie, Alberta. The business owns and operates hotels in Western Canada. Alyeska is currently owned by John Byrne, who lives in Alta, Utah, and bought the resort in 2006.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
What if free speech and civility could coexist? Join the University of Alaska on October 12th for a public discussion of this timely topic. The forum will feature a noon presentation by the author of the book Free Speech on Campus, Erwin Chemerinsky, as well as the Seawolf debate team, taking up the topic of whether the future of democracy depends on limiting free speech. Friday, October 12th at the UAA Fine Arts Building. The event begins at 11 a.m. For more or to live stream the forum, go to www.alaska.edu/freespeech. This message sponsored by University of Alaska.
A First Nations tribe in British Columbia is suing the operator of a U.S. fuel barge that spilled thousands of gallons of diesel near the tribe's reserve nearly 2 years ago. Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports.
Heltsuk First Nations member Kelly Brown got close enough in his boat to make out the name of a grounded tug.
Nathan E. Stewart sunk. There's fuel just flowing out of the boat.
He shared video of the encounter in the Inside Passage that was reposted by the Vancouver Sun. Fortunately, the tug's accompanying fuel barge had delivered its load in Ketchikan and was nearly empty. Still, around 26,000 gallons of diesel and other oils from the southbound tug Nathan E. Stewart spilled that morning. An investigation later found a crew member had fallen asleep during watch. Nearly 2 years later to the day, the Heltsuk Tribal Council filed a lawsuit against the BC and Canadian governments. The suit also names crew members and their employer, Houston-based Kirby Corporation, which regularly ships fuel from Washington State to ports in Alaska. The Heltsuk First Nations Hereditary Chief Frank Brown addressed reporters in Vancouver.
Our law has been violated, and the legal action we are taking in the BC Supreme Court today is our attempt, our bid, to hold industry and government accountable for this negligence.
The Kirby Corporation released a short statement saying its lawyers were reviewing the claim the company would defend its interests in court. BC's Environment Ministry said it's committed to engaging with the First Nation tribe as appropriate for a federally led initiative seeking ocean protection. Citing the lawsuit, neither would comment further. The October 13, 2016 spill ignited concerns about Canada's spill response capabilities in the Inside Passage. It reportedly took the first Canadian Coast Guard vessel 20 hours to reach the spill site from its port in Prince Rupert. The Heltsuk First Nations has been pushing for spill response capabilities of its own. Those efforts were redoubled last November when an Alaska-bound fuel barge ran into trouble near Bella Bella, BC. The northbound Jake Shearer broke free from the fuel barge it was towing. This time it was fully loaded with about 3.7 million gallons of various petroleum fuels. But its crew was able to drop anchors before it hit the rocks. Marilyn Slett is the elected chief counselor of the tribe. She said Alaska-bound fuel barges remain a worry around her hometown, Bella Bella.
And our community has definitely raised a lot of concern around the articulated barges. And, you know, certainly we're living through the experience with the Nathan E. Stewart and the near miss with the Jake Shearers.
The Canadian government has proposed exclusionary zones for oil tankers in the Inside Passage, but the Alaska-bound fuel barges are below the tonnage threshold and would be exempt from the rule. The lawsuit seeks damages for the loss of clam beds the tribe says remain contaminated since the spill. It also accuses Kirby Corporation of recklessness by having only one crew member available to stand watch at night. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
It's official. 2018 was the largest sockeye salmon run to Bristol Bay on record. And the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has records dating back to 1893. The 2018 Bristol Bay season summary from Fish and Game reiterates the records this year's run broke. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
To start with, the total run to Bristol Bay this summer was 62.3 million sockeye. That's the most ever and way above the preseason forecast of 51.3 million fish. The Nuujagak District set a new record for the largest single-district sockeye salmon harvest at 24.1 million sockeye, and that accounted for more than half the reds harvested in the bay this summer. Togiak also set a record for sockeye return to its district. Tim Sands, Fish and Game Area Management Biologist for Togiak and Nuujagak, noted that the length of the run, rather than a concentrated peak, drove up those numbers.
It started picking up early in July, but it still wasn't anything exceptional. It just went on and on and on with good catches.
The Bristol Bay ex-vessel value also broke a record. That's the total amount fishermen were paid for their catches. $281 million for all salmon species. That's almost 2.5 times the 20-year average. Sockeye brought an average $1.26 per pound base price. The total harvest across all five districts was 41.3 million sockeye, the second largest harvest in the fishery's history. As fishermen observed during the summer, the fish were smaller than average. The average weight of each red was just 5.3 pounds. Fish and Game noted that fish that lived in salt water for 3 years were closer to long-term average weights, but the fish that lived 2 years in salt water were smaller. Sands pointed out that the majority of the huge Nooshigak run is made up of sockeye that live in the ocean for 2 years, and that brought the bay-wide average sockeye size down.
It all kind of points to just that one age class being more numerous and maybe a little bit smaller than average.
He hypothesized that the ocean's carrying capacity is limited, and fish size could be correlated with the number of fish that return to Bristol Bay.
If the number of salmon out there is bigger than average, then there's less food for each individual fish, and it kind of drives either the size or the survivorship down.
Obviously, the survivorship in some Bristol Bay districts was high this year, but salmon returns around much of the state were shockingly low. Sands warned that Bristol Bay is not immune.
The day will come when we don't have record runs and we're in the same situation that some of these other places were in this year. Despite our best efforts, you don't catch 5.5 million fish in the Nooshigak district on average by catching 24 million fish every year. That's not how averages work. The variability of nature demands that there will be ups and downs.
In terms of other salmon species, Bristol Bay fishermen harvested 41,000 Chinook, 1.9 million chum, 220,000 pinks, and 140,000 silvers. The pink harvest was roughly half the 20-year average. The coho harvest, while significantly lower than last year's, was still above average. Sands noted that some fishermen seemed disappointed with this year's pink and silver fisheries. He said several factors likely contributed to the outcomes. The run timing to the Naknek, Kwijak, Igigik, and Ugashik districts was the latest on record. Fishermen who might otherwise have fished for pinks and silvers were still busy catching reds in those districts. On top of that, an oil spill from a capsized tender closed the Nooshigak district for nearly a week at the end of July. Still, taken as a whole, it was a banner year in Bristol Bay. Every river in the bay met or exceeded its escapement goal for reds. In all, 21 million sockeye made it to their natal streams to spawn. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. Like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at AK Public News. We had reports tonight from Nat Herz and Abby Collins in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Aaron Bolton in Homer, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Jacob Resnick in Juneau, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Never miss another episode of your favorite PBS primetime programs thanks to Afternoon Tea on Alaska Public Media TV. Every weekday you can catch up on the drama of Masterpiece. Be amazed by our universe with Nature and Nova. Search for garage treasures on Antiques Roadshow and solve mysteries alongside our favorite detectives. Watch Afternoon Tea weekdays from 3 to 5 p.m. only on Alaska Public Media TV. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.